Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We want to welcome with us this morning Wisconsin Dell students. Would they please rise? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The Wisconsin Dell students are here with us with the Court with Class program that the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin administer. This is a national award-winning program. The students are invited to come. They are given material about the case we are about to hear, and then they visit with a justice at noon. And today that justice is Justice Prosser. And since we've met you all, I'll introduce the court to you. I'll start with our speaker at noon, Justice Prosser at the far right, my far right. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. At my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is an empty chair, but it's ordinarily occupied by Justice John Wilcox. Justice Wilcox had surgery and he is recuperating, but he will not be participating in this case. To the empty chair's left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left is Justice Diane Sykes. The students will meet with Justice Prosser at noon today and may be joined by other students. We shall see. The first case today is 99-2441 and 000454, In Re the Commitment of Harris D. Byers. Arguing for Mr. Byers is Assistant State Public Defender Jeffrey Olson. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Jeffrey Olson. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender. I'm appearing for Harris Byers in this matter. The threshold and primary issue in this case is the meaning of Section 980.02, subsection 1, paragraph A and B of the statutes. Those paragraphs set out a procedure for initiating a petition or initiating a sexually violent person commitment proceeding. The Court of Appeals in this case, in an unpublished decision, found that the statute was unambiguous and that the district attorney had authority to file a petition even though the agency with jurisdiction, which in this case was the Department of Corrections, had not requested that a Chapter 980 petition be filed in the case. The factual background, as the Court is aware, is that Mr. Byers was coming to a release date, a mandatory release date. He was evaluated by the Department of Corrections. They did not think he met the criteria for Chapter 980, so no request was made to the Department of Justice to file a petition. The district attorney got their own evaluation toward or near the release date in November of 1998 and submitted their own petition based on that evaluation, and that's how the proceeding began. Mr. Byers brought a motion to dismiss, which was denied by the trial court, arguing that the district attorney did not have authority to file a petition because there had been no request from the Department of Corrections for a Chapter 980 petition. As the court is also aware, having had State v. Thomas argued in this case a couple of years ago, the Court of Appeals has in different decisions found the statute to be unambiguous and clear on its face, but two different panels have come to opposite conclusions about what that clear and unambiguous language means. In Thomas and in this case, in Shaw and in this case, the District 3 found that the statute allows the DA to petition, even though there's no request from the agency with jurisdiction, And District 2, in the case of State v. Thomas, found the statute was clear and unambiguous and that the DA clearly had no authority to petition if the agency with jurisdiction did not ask for a petition. Because of that split, and because I think both of those readings are reasonable readings by well-informed persons, I think this Court should find that the statute is actually ambiguous and should employ the canons of construction to interpret the statute and resort to legislative history to find the appropriate meaning, the legislature's intent in this statute, in this case. In particular, in this case, we believe the Court of Appeals' opinion was wrong because it doesn't comport with the canons of construction and it doesn't comport or make sense of the legislative history in this case. We also believe that there are very good, legitimate, rational policy reasons for the legislature to have decided that the Department of Corrections or the Department of Health and Family Services, the agency with jurisdiction, should do an initial screening, and only after they've made a determination that the criteria may be met should a petition be filed. First, I'll talk about why I think the reading offered by Mr. Byers makes more sense in terms of the canons of construction. One canon, of course, as the Court is aware, is that the Court should avoid making or rendering any language in a statute superfluous. And as we've argued in the brief, and as District 2 found in Thomas, a reading that the DA can file without any petition or any request from the agency with jurisdiction would render a specific phrase in the statute superfluous. And specifically that is the provision in paragraph B, which says that the district attorney may file if the Department of Justice does not file under paragraph A. It's that phrase under paragraph A that would be rendered superfluous if the agency with jurisdiction request was not a condition precedent for the filing.
No, because the reference to paragraph A could just mean to the Attorney General. It doesn't necessarily carry with it the Department of Corrections.
But the Department of Corrections itself, or I'm sorry, the agency with jurisdiction is included as a condition precedent for DOJ acting under paragraph A. One of the substantive provisions of paragraph A is that the Department of Justice act at the request of the agency with jurisdiction. And that actually connects to another canon. I cited this in my reply brief. The notion that a cross-reference in a statute is meant to incorporate the substantive provisions of the referred to statute. And the cross-reference in paragraph B dealing with the DA's authority is to paragraph A, and therefore that should include all the substantive provisions of paragraph A, one of which is a request from the agency with jurisdiction. The other thing.
Where do you find that canon?
Pardon me?
Where do you find that canon?
It's the most recent case I cited, and this is in my reply brief on page 3, the State v. Gibbs, which is a Court of Appeals case also dealing with a Chapter 980 commitment. And that dealt with whether the whether Chapter 980 covered juveniles who are found delinquent under Chapter 938. Because when the legislature revised the Juvenile Justice Code and renumbered everything into Chapter 938, there were no cross-references put into Chapter 980 referring back to Chapter 938. It still only referred back to Chapter 48. And the Court of Appeals in that case found that the cross-reference was a shorthand for the substantive provisions in dealing with juvenile delinquency. And therefore, the legislature must have intended that Chapter 938 juveniles be included as well.
Is there anything in the LRB drafting manual that says the same thing?
There is. I don't have the citation with me, but the drafting manual generally talks about using cross-references as a way to incorporate incorporate provisions in other places. It's commonly done with definitions, but it can be done also with the substantive provisions of another statute, so they don't have to be repeated every time.
Mr. Olson, if what you're arguing for was indeed the intent of the legislature, wouldn't it have been very simple to add to subparagraph B the words "at the request of the agency with jurisdiction"? But why allow a statute to be, as you're now characterizing it, ambiguous, when if that was indeed the intent, that would have made it very clear?
Yes, although there's I think that the way what happened here was that this was meant to develop or state steps in a process. And the steps in the process were that the agency with jurisdiction did the screening. Then it was, if they thought the person met the criteria, it was referred to the Department of Justice. And then if the Department of Justice decided not to prosecute for whatever reason, then the DA got it. So it wouldn't necessarily be the case that the district attorney was given a direct referral from the agency with jurisdiction. It was going through these steps of agency with jurisdiction to DOJ, then to the DA.
But in effect, what you're doing is reading the words "at the request of the agency with jurisdiction" into B, aren't you?
By virtue of the cross-reference to paragraph A.
You're reading in "at the request of the agency with jurisdiction and the failure of the AG to act."
Right.
Or the refusal.
I think it may not necessarily be that a refusal or failure. It could be that they've decided between themselves, the AG and the DA, that the DA can take this case for whatever reason.
You need two steps, one, the agency, and two, the AG not acting.
Right, for whatever reason.
The basic policy that you are espousing is that the Department of Corrections must make a request before either the Department of Justice or any district attorney is able to move forward. Is that correct?
Right, or the Department of Health and Family Services, whichever agency has jurisdiction.
All right. Why does that make sense as a policy matter? Why would the legislature have done that?
Well, I think several reasons. First, the agency with jurisdiction has had this person in their care and custody or under their supervision most recently. In some of these cases, the person was sentenced years before, and the local DA will have essentially lost a lot of the personal contact with the person after that point in time. Now that the person's in this under the supervision of the agency with jurisdiction, they will have the most up-to-date information. They will have, in addition, the knowledge and expertise that they develop in treating and supervising and dealing with these kinds of offenders. Having them do an initial screening takes advantage of their knowledge and experience, and in fact encourages them or requires them to develop that knowledge and expertise even further. It also allows for a sort of consistent and coordinated process for filing petitions. Otherwise, if there's just a general notice that people are going to be released, then the prosecutorial agencies have to either scramble or work amongst themselves on a relatively short-term basis to decide who's going to do what, who's going to take the petition or not. It also means that there's some consistency in evaluations. If you have specified employees or units in the departments doing these kinds of evaluations, they'll develop a sort of statewide perspective as to all the classes of offenders that they have out there, all the types of offenders, and who most meets the criteria for the statute. The other thing is that, as this court has recognized, Chapter 980 is is meant to be narrow. It's supposed to sweep narrowly to those offenders who need this kind of treatment and commitment because they have a mental condition that predisposes them to commit further acts. They're not a typical recidivist. And that treatment rationale is an important part of the constitutional underpinnings of this law. It's not supposed to be retributive or punishment or deterrence. Having independent experts in the agency with jurisdiction do the initial screening advances that sort of interest of the state in getting at this very narrow class. They'll have the expertise to better know who that narrow class is. They'll be insulated from some of the potentially local political pressure that a district attorney without that sort of screening process may be subject to. They will also help assure that the people who are being committed are actually going to be people that the Department of Health and Family Services will agree needs treatment.
Let me ask this. You've given quite a complete explanation of the policy reason for this. Where is that policy or those policy reasons reflected in the legislative history?
I think they're not illustrated in the sense that there's a memo somewhere saying exactly that this is the reason we're doing this. I think we have to make inferences from the record. The best inference is the way the bill changed. The bill originally allowed the district attorney to file. They were the first in line, essentially. And that plenary authority was augmented by the Department of Justice being able to file either at the request of the district attorney, if perhaps they just needed the manpower or the expertise from DOJ or by the agency with jurisdiction. That provision was explicitly deleted by the legislature at an amendment adopted by the Joint Finance Committee. And the language that we now have was substituted for it. And the drafting records, which are in the appendix, specifically page 151 of our brief, the appellant's brief, indicate that there was a draft that was never introduced that referred to the Department of Justice having the only authority to file a petition. And Joint Finance took that and amended it to allow the present language that the district attorney could file once the Department of Justice had refused. And
Wait a second.
Sure.
I think I heard you say that there was a draft never amended that said only the Department of Justice could do this. What draft is that?
Not introduced. I think if you look on page 151 of our appendix, there's a reference to 4713. And that is not in the drafting file, and the implication from that is that it was never introduced. It was used as a starting document for the Amendment 2, which was eventually introduced.
Well, at this point in time, are people able to get access to draft 4713/1?
No. Because it was not introduced, the LRB policy is that it remains confidential.
Well, how is it that you can tell us then what that draft says?
Well, I'm inferring that from the parenthetical material next to that draft number. It says Huber, who was a representative on, and I think it's public record that he was on the Joint Finance Committee at that time, and it says DOJ only. And then underneath it says 4713 as amended. And then the next line is the amendment. If DOJ refuses, the DA of either the receiving county, the county where the person would be released to, or the county of conviction can do the petition. And that's what I infer from that, and I concede it's not, there's no explicit statement, but that's what all that read together suggests, that was how the Joint Finance committee sort of struck the balance between the who should be filing the petition.
And where did this document come from?
This is in the drafting file for 1993 Wisconsin Act 479, the original enactment of Chapter 980. And this is specifically the drafting file for Assembly Amendment 2. Or actually, this would be Senate Amendment 2, which was identical to Assembly Amendment 2. So, but again, I think the important thing in the history is the way the bill changed to take out the language that the DA had the first shot and the plenary authority. And that is the way the Court of Appeals read the law to be now. But that ignores the fact that it was completely flipped around by the legislature at the time they enacted this bill.
Counsel, your opposing counsel at pages 8 and 9 of maybe even 10 of his brief advances the proposition that a DA has greater authority than the DOJ. A DA has greater authority because, number one, there need be no referral, and number two, that the petition can be filed within 90 days before or after, and that it's asserted that the DOJ can only do it 90 days before if you do not read sub A into sub B. Is there any legislative history set forth in the appendix that addresses the issue or the proposition that a DA is to have greater authority?
On the first point, that the fact that there are two district attorneys who can file as opposed to just one, which, as it started out originally.
That's the way you responded, if I recall, in your reply brief,
right,
pointing out to the two district attorneys. But I'm focusing more, actually, in my mind, on the 90-day after,
right,
which I thought was inconsistent. You cite, I think, a couple of Court of Appeals opinions, but I think we've addressed that issue, too. And so that perplexes me, 90 days
right
after.
I don't think they have that authority. As the cases I cited in my reply brief at page 4 say that it has to be done before release. There is nothing, at least in the legislative history in the appendix, addressing that.
Indeed, that's my question.
Right.
Is there anything in the appendix that you could argue either way on the premise advanced by your opposing counsel that the DA has greater authority?
The only thing I can that tends to go to that question is the fact that originally the legislature said that DOJ had to make up its mind at least 30 days before release so that the DA would have time to get his or her ducks in a row to file a petition in the event that the DA was going to do it. That was vetoed by the governor when he signed the bill in the interest of giving the Department of Justice flexibility. And I think what was happening at that time was that when the law was just starting to get going, there were a number of people very close to release date that they wanted to try and petition, and they couldn't. There's no way they could do it within 30 days. And so I think that was the flexibility they wanted, although I'm not exactly sure. But the point is that if DOJ had to act 30 days before release, then that really implies that everybody's got to act before release, within that 90-day period leading up to release and not a period after. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been the need to force DOJ to move quickly and make a decision.
How do you square that, though, with 980.04 and the language in that subsection of the statute which contemplates procedures for respondents who are not in custody?
I guess I have read that. I saw that in the state's brief, and it seems to me that the way to read that is custody under Chapter 980, a detention order of some sort under 980. I think in theory a person could be subject to a 980 petition but be out on parole on the street. And I think in virtually every case I'm aware of, the state files and the court grants a detention order upon the filing of the petition. But I'm not sure that's not required under the statute. They can ask for one. And so I think that that contemplates situations where the person, they file the petition before the release date and the person is paroled, and they're out on parole, essentially like on bail, while the petition is pending. And then they're taken into custody either because the court issues a detention order or because they're taken into custody to do the evaluation after the petition has been filed. In terms of policy, just if I could wrap up one sort of final policy reason is, as the court's aware, these are complex cases. They require a lot of expertise. The treatment needs of people committed under the chapter are substantial and require long-term care. The legislature recently required that a person committed spend a minimum of 18 months in confinement, not confinement, but secure treatment setting. And another reason to have these cases screened by independent experts at the state agency level is to conserve scarce resources, both on the trial level for the DAs and the courts who have to, or the Department of Justice and the DAs and the courts who have to hear these cases, but also for the treatment providers. To make sure that the people that are actually being committed under the statute are those most in need of treatment, most amenable to treatment, proper subjects for treatment, and that they're not sort of taking the place of, they're not places or beds aren't being filled by people who otherwise don't appear to meet the criteria of the commitment statute. I see my warning light is on. Are there any other questions before my red light comes on?
Mr. Olson, I'd like to ask you to comment on the flow chart that appears on 143 of your brief.
Right. I think I responded to that in the reply brief. I don't think it matches the text of the actual manual itself. And I think that the text is clearer that once they've done the end of confinement review board and the special purpose evaluation, if they get that far, and the person is not determined to be, or they don't think the person's met the criteria, then they begin release planning. And it seems to me that the department wouldn't go into release planning if they still knew that the DA was out there with the possibility or with the chance to file a petition, that there would be some process for clearing with the DA whether a petition was going to be filed or not, so that they knew what was going to be happening to the person. To the extent that they're just inconsistent and the appendix should be given as much weight as the text, I think it just suggests yet again how this statute can be read by differently, one by a person writing a text and another by a person doing a flowchart. And I think that's my best response to that. My argument is that the Department of Corrections reading is, again, supports a finding of ambiguity, and not that it's, you know, not that the court is necessarily bound by anything the Department of Corrections interprets the statute to be anyway. And I see my red light is on.
I see that you haven't argued the Laxton issues. Are you leaving that for your brief?
Pardon me? I missed the very last part.
I'm sorry. But are you still standing on those issues?
We are. I would note the court is aware from if it wasn't aware before from Mr. Green's letter to the court that the Supreme Court did deny the petition for certiorari in Laxton.
So do you think that precludes your arguments?
It doesn't preclude the argument. We don't concede that Laxton is correctly decided. We also, even apart from Laxton, which dealt with a jury instruction issue, this is an issue of what the person has to be told when they're making an admission. And we still think that the person should be informed of that difficulty to control element.
So those issues are still alive?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Kevin C. Green, representing the state of Wisconsin. You're from the Brown County District Attorney's Office. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. Again, I'm representing the state of Wisconsin in this hearing because it does involve the authority of the district attorney's offices throughout the state to file. I have listened to arguments this morning, and I think we need to step back one step further than much of the debate. The initial question, of course, is the statute ambiguous on its face? To that, the state says no. If you simply read the language, the state contends it is clear that the district attorney's offices have the authority to file without a referral. This, of course, was the holding of the court below. The standard review here is obviously a de novo review. Mr. Byers argues that because lower courts in unpublished decisions have disagreed, it shows ambiguity. As I stated in my brief, I think that misses the point. This is a de novo review. The question to be concerned with is what this court believes. The lower court opinions have no precedential value, and in my opinion, under State versus Sodegaard, are in fact extrinsic evidence being used to create an ambiguity where none exists. That, I think, is the point that I wish to emphasize the most today. Simply looking at the language, ignoring whether or not it's good policy, the question is the language. We're interpreting the statute. While I disagree with their policy analysis, I think the language is clear. The phrase under paragraph A is set off from the remainder of that sentence. It does not continue to apply through the district attorney's offices. That is a reference back to where the Department of Justice gets their authority and their procedure. Nothing in the language intimates that that is intended to apply to the district attorney's offices.
May I ask you a question here? If the Department of Corrections requests the Department of Justice to file a petition and the Department of Justice declines to do so, where does that fall under the statute?
I believe it then goes to the point that the district attorney's office may file if the Department of Justice has not.
I mean, you'd rely on sub B then, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would. And either of two district attorneys would then have the authority to file.
And under sub B, you would refer back to paragraph A.
That's where I think we disagree. I don't know that you necessarily refer back to paragraph A other than that the Department of Justice has not filed. Again, it's the state's position that paragraph A does not describe the procedure for the district attorney's office. The only condition...
But clearly, if the Department of Corrections has requested for the petition be filed and the Department of Justice declines, that all of that is under paragraph A, is it not?
I would agree.
Okay. And if the Department of Corrections does not request, then what... Then the Department of Justice cannot go forward. Is that right?
As I read the statute, that is correct.
And that's because of paragraph A?
Correct. That's a difference between the authorities that are provided in the statute. The Department of Justice must have a referral from the agency of jurisdiction, usually the Department of Corrections in most cases, although not all cases. However, that same restriction is not placed on the district attorney's office. Had the legislature wished to do so, it could have simply done it by putting that language under sub 1 rather than under 1A. It was easily drafted to show that the agency with jurisdiction must refer before anyone has authority. They did not do that. They drafted the language as the court can read today. I believe that demonstrates that that was not the legislature's intent.
What? Does the county DA have to wait for anything before filing a petition? They get the notice under the section right before 02, 015 or whatever it is. They get notice that this is going to happen. Do they have to wait for anything before they file a petition?
In theory, no. In effect, though, they do have to wait to see if the Department of Justice files. If both would file, for example.
Why would they have to wait at all?
Again, theoretically, they don't. There's nothing restricting their ability to file right at that time. If they would file and the Department of Justice would subsequently file, I believe the Department of Justice would be able to proceed. The DA would be required to dismiss their case under 980.02. But do they have to wait to file? No, nothing in the statute specifically says that.
You're saying that if the DA files and then Justice files, Justice would get to dismiss the first case?
I don't know if Justice would dismiss it, but I believe that the DA, as an officer of the court, should then dismiss the file as the Department of Justice the first chance to file.
Could two DAs file petitions?
Certainly, as two different district attorney's offices have authority to file, either the county of intended residence or county of last conviction, you could have a case where both district attorney's offices file.
And which one would apply? I mean, which one would go forward?
Nothing in the statute clearly delineates that. I believe that would require some communication between the two district attorney's offices.
It doesn't say that, though. Sub B, sub 1B says, if the Department of Justice does not file a petition under paragraph A, the district attorney for one of the following, which implies that two cannot be going forward at the same time. It's got to be either or, right?
I would agree that only one of them may actually proceed through. And I think maybe I made a distinction there between filing and actually proceeding under the filing.
Well, the prefatory language in sub 1 refers to filing. A petition alleging that a person is a sexually violent person may be filed by one of the following.
That's certainly
not
true. I appreciate
process, but filed.
Perhaps that's a misunderstanding on my part, and I'm, again, interpreting the statute to the best of my ability. I agree that not more than one district attorney can proceed. The filing language clearly in the statute then would indicate only one may file. As to which would file, I believe would require simple communication between the two attorneys' offices.
Well, your position also that the DA doesn't have to wait to see what DOJ does, it runs contrary to the prefatory language in sub B, which says if the Department of Justice does not file, then the DA of one of these counties can file.
That gets into, I guess, my concern of timing. How long does the DA have to wait is different, I think, than when the authority actually begins. The question is whether or not the Department of Justice has filed a petition, but doesn't say specifically on what date or what the deadline was. The original language proposed was that the Department of Justice would have to do so 30 days before discharge to allow the district attorney's time to then review the case and make a decision. That language was struck by the governor, but I believe the effect then creates a question as to how long the DA must wait to see if a filing occurs.
But you agree that either the DA or the Department of Justice files because the prefatory language says may be filed by one of the following, so both shall not file.
Both should not file.
So one has to file, and it would appear as if it's the AG's office, since B says if the Department of Justice doesn't file, then the DA for one of the following files. Well, since we're having so much discussion, how can you then say that the statute is not ambiguous?
Your Honor, I believe...
With a straight face.
argue many things with a straight face that maybe I shouldn't. Your Honor, I'm relying mainly on the prior decisions, courts far more learned than I am, ruling that it's unambiguous.
But you got two conflicting decisions, at least two conflicting decisions by the Court of Appeals, right?
I agree, Your Honor. And as I argued again, the question I think I'm trying to restrict is the plain language on its face as you sit and read it. The, again, State versus Sotogayor case says that you shouldn't rely on extrinsic evidence if it is clear. Mm-hmm. I believe relying on prior lower court decisions would, in fact, be using extrinsic evidence. The questions on the wording.
You think interpretation of a statute is extrinsic evidence? A court interpretation of a statute is extrinsic evidence.
A lower court's opinion, when arguing in front of this court, I believe, in fact, may be extrinsic evidence, yes. Because this is a de novo review, Your Honor.
Well, that may be subject to interpretation, but clearly the fact that you got two courts going in two different ways would indicate there's a conflict, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Might indicate that two reasonable courts have decided it differently, or do you label one of these as an unreasonable interpretation?
I would never presume to do so.
Well, then you get a problem.
And again, Your Honor, I believe it would be my interpretation that very often appellate courts do come to different conclusions, mm-hmm. necessitating decisions by this court. That is not a unique or unheard of situation here. That in itself does not make that an ambiguous statute.
I know, and you'll find cases that state that.
And I think that is the proposition I'm attempting to make today to Your Honor and the rest of the court. This is not an unusual situation to be in, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean that the statute's ambiguous, simply because courts disagree.
Well, let's just pretend that the statute's ambiguous. When you look at extrinsic evidence, do you have any support for your interpretation?
Your Honor, if you approach it from the legislative history, you again get into a matter of interpretation, I think, on what has occurred in the past. The original proposal allowed for the District Attorney's Office to file, and the Department of Justice, upon request of either the agency or one of the District Attorney's offices. The bill as proposed obviously changed that language, and it changed a couple of provisions in that language. The first is, there was a cost attached to the district attorney filing. That cost was taken out. Mr. Byers argues that the legislature did not want district attorneys to have control of the purse strings, that is to require the cost. Yet district attorneys have that authority every day in every criminal case. When they sentence or argue if someone should be put into a prison system, it is a Department of Corrections facility, state funds. That is not an unusual situation. Also look at the other change, adding the district attorney for the county of intended residence. Why make that addition if you did not intend the district attorneys to have the authority to file? It simply makes little sense to add that district attorney without any real authority to review the case and file without a referral from an agency. Instead, I believe that history demonstrates the intent of the legislature. I also believe, despite Mr. Byers' argument, the language they say that only DOJ could file, that the state did not have that authority, was never put forth.
Could you say that again, please?
The language that they referred to, and it refers to, I believe, page 151 of appellant's brief, has one little note that only DOJ could file, and that's an argument made by Mr. Byers. That language was never put forth. It was never even, as far as I can tell, offered. I think that shows the legislature's intent that that not be the case.
Counsel, is it your plain meaning interpretation, is your plain meaning interpretation as follows, that under sub B, the district attorney is in no way subject to any limitation set forth in sub A?
Other than that, the Department of Justice has not filed, yes.
Okay, so that there is one limitation. As a quick look at sub A leads me to see three potential limitations. One, a referral. Two, the DOJ has filed. And three, they have to file before the date of the release or discharge. So those are three limitations. And it's your position that the only limitation of sub A that is imposed on sub B is the limitation that the Department of Justice has to, for whatever reason, not file.
I believe that to be accurate, although I should qualify with that, Your Honor. The authority of the district attorney's office to file after discharge is, in my opinion, theoretical. I don't know that it's ever been done.
Is theoretical, did you say?
Theoretically, it is contained in the statute. Again, I've never seen it done, nor have I heard any specific challenges to the authority. But to not interpret it that way, I believe, would cause other sections of the statute to be rendered void. The provisions for allowing filing afterwards, arguably, again, the way the language is written. The fact that it contains provisions for taking someone into custody after a finding of probable cause, if the person is out on release. If it is not read that way, I fear that you are making those sections void or have no effect. Again, in my brief, I believe I say arguably, because again, I don't know that it has been challenged by the court and decided one way or the other. There are some appellate decisions, but none that I can tell are directly on point. Respondent states two cases, but I don't know that they are exactly on that point. State versus Farm is filing on the day of discharge, but again, I don't believe that applies to the situation we have here. So I don't believe that case to be on point precisely.
Are you advancing the argument that the two cases, Court of Appeals cases cited by your opposing counsel on that issue, Farm being one of them, only apply to the Department of Justice and not to DAs, or are you not advancing?
I'm not advancing that position. What I'm stating is it's unclear from the opinion as I read it that it applies to the situations like the ones we have here, where the Department of Justice has not filed, the district attorney files, and if it could be beyond the 90 days. As to Farm, I simply don't know that it goes that far or is that precise.
Aren't you taking let me put it this way. I think one of the problems with your opponent's position is that the Department of Corrections or the Department of Health and Family Services has total control whether any law enforcement agency can go forward. I think an anomaly in your position is that the Brown County District Attorney's Office is far more powerful than the Attorney General and the Department of Justice. I mean, isn't that why would the legislature, in concert with the Department of Justice, who was helping with this bill, have drafted that?
Your Honor, I believe if you look at the history of the relation between the Department of Justice and the District Attorney's Office in a typical case, the Department of Justice has authority throughout the state, while the District Attorney has only authority in that county. In that county, however, the District Attorney is the elected official charged with protecting the public. They have very wide-ranging authority to use their discretion, in some cases referred to as quasi-judicial authority, to file under certain guidelines. I don't think it is that unusual that the district attorney's office would be granted, I don't know if power is the right word, but greater authority to file. Because that is not that unusual. The Attorney General's office or Department of Justice can only file in those cases in which they have been granted authority to do so, for the most part. Again, that is not true for a district attorney in their own county. And I believe that is a very big difference and a very simple explanation as to why there is a difference. And I'm certain respondent will, Mr. Byers will argue against that policy, but that in fact is what the history has been. And I believe that district attorney's offices generally have the authority. They are the ones responsible to the people, just as the legislators are who pass this law, responsible to the same constituents. But it is generally the district attorney who is charged with protecting the public.
Could I ask you, when the DA goes forward with a petition without the Department of Justice and without the Department of Corrections or Health and Family Services providing information for a probable cause hearing, what does the DA use as evidence?
As they did in this case, Your Honor, when it has happened in the past, the state generally hires their own expert, someone qualified to render the same opinions, and gets information from that doctor and provides that as the basis for their petition. In this case, the state hired Dr. Woods. His report was that Mr. Byers was indeed a person who would qualify as a sexually violent offender.
Dr. Wood meet with Mr. Byers?
Your Honor, I apologize. My remembrance of that part of the record is vague. As the court is likely aware, the respondent is not required to meet with a psychologist. However, having done a number of these trials, the psychologist will tell you they are able to render an opinion without direct contact with the respondent. And in fact, is done.
Can the defendant bring in evidence that the department failed to proceed? Maybe its psychologist or psychiatrist rendered an opinion otherwise?
Certainly. This is a probable cause hearing. They're certainly entitled to present evidence. And that is another important point. It is not that the respondent, or in this case, Mr. Byers, was left without recourse. He is not detained without an order from the court. A judge must sign the order for detention. There must be some evidence to satisfy that judge. A probable cause hearing is then held. The statute requires 72 hours. The protections are there. There must be some evidence. It's not as if either Department of Justice or District Attorney's Office can file these whenever they choose. There must be some evidence there, or there'll be no detention and no probable cause.
That's very little evidence, isn't it, under probable cause?
It's a lower standard. It's been analogized to a criminal probable cause hearing.
So all you need is one psychologist or psychiatrist. That's enough, even if you got five on the other side.
Your Honor, having lost probable cause hearings, I don't know if that's necessarily true with all due respect. Some judges have, in fact, dismissed cases that were filed for lack of probable cause, even where a psychologist has testified.
They weigh the testimony.
They weigh the testimony and determine there's insufficient evidence to even meet the probable cause burden.
Even though it ultimately, this goes to a jury, doesn't it, if they want, ultimately?
If either side requests a jury trial, yes, it would be a jury. Some go to court trials. My experience is with jury trial. Within 45 days, Your Honor.
One of the things that's lingering in the back of my mind, and I want to put it on the table so you have an opportunity to address it, is this. Around and north of Highway 8, we've had some difficulties with some what I might call renegade DAs in the last decade, or recently retired DAs. We had a string of them that were publicly disciplined by the state and that were convicted of crimes. That underscores for me the potential, and some of them involved responding to political pressures, the potential for DAs, if left unchecked, to indiscriminately file petitions for sexual predators. You know, I can see as a campaign slogan, you know, I filed more petitions for sexual predators to keep you folks safe than any other DA in the state. You know, that person would win. How do you respond to that concern that's lingering in the back of my mind? Maybe you should say to me, it has no place, get rid of it in this case. But I want to put it on the table for you to address.
In some respects, there are some built-in protections, as I've mentioned. The probable cause hearings, no detention, again, occurs without a judicial order. I'm not certain that is a grounds to find ambiguity in the statute, which I believe is the question before the court.
That's right. If you are arguing plain meaning, you say to me, what is in the back of your mind should be thrown out, has no place. If you get beyond plain meaning and get to ambiguity, then policy considerations advanced by your opposing counsel that there be uniformity in approach, do come into play. And my question in part deals with this, you know, uniformity in approach.
Again, Your Honor, there's always a possibility that a district attorney will not comport themselves with the requirements of the ethical rules. But those rules are in place as a protection. The constituents are there for cases where people have been disciplined and subsequently been voted out of office. Can it happen? I think anything can happen. But I don't believe that that is the policy or the concern here. There are enough protections in place so that I don't believe that is a true concern. Again, and I hate to keep repeating it, but you have the 72-hour probable cause hearing. That is a rapid ruling. I'll admit it's a lower standard than at trial, but you'll have some protections, much like a criminal defendant would have. You have, again, no detention without a court order. That is another protection that I don't think can be ignored. If the concern here is that a person will be detained unjustly, you have judicial review almost immediately if there's nothing there. If there's no psychologist who's going to be able to testify to the requisite level, the judge likely wouldn't sign that detention order. If they do, they have the probable cause hearing to quickly make that determination. And while I understand the concern, again, I believe there are adequate protections put into place. I believe the longstanding policies of the apparent authority between Department of Justice and the district attorneys explains that, just as a DA could go rampant on drunk driving cases or drug cases, filing everything that comes before them, I believe that there are restrictions in place, as well as the ethical rules themselves, which can be enforced. I see I am already partway into my yellow light. Are there any further questions? Rather than me just speaking.
This is a very unfair question. I noticed the drafter of this bill is named Jeffrey E. Olson, which coincidentally is the same name as your opposing counsel. How does the court deal with that?
Your Honor, I'm going to admit I did not discover that until this morning, looking more at the substance than the drafter. I would deal with it or suggest this. That language that appears with his name is the same language I refer to as not having been offered for many of the restrictions they're asking for. The question today, Your Honor, is what does the language say now? I believe it's clear and unambiguous. You don't get the legislative history But even if you do, I believe the history shows that that position, the one espoused by Mr. Byers, was rejected. That was not put forth, and therefore is of little effect to this court. Because of that, again, I don't believe it is of great support to respondent's position. Are there any further questions?
I hear no further questions. Well, thank you, Mr. Green.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Olson, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to start by reminding the court that it can look at legislative history in situations other than when a statute's ambiguous. As District 2 pointed out in the Thomas case, when District 2 found this language to be clear and unambiguous and interpreted it the way Mr. Byers argues it should be interpreted, they looked at legislative history to bolster what they thought was the clear and plain meaning of the statute. And they cited State v. Martin for that proposition. So the court is not limited or prohibited from looking at the legislative history only if it finds the statute ambiguous. It can look even if it does find the statute clear. That being said, we still think the statute is ambiguous, and that's the reason the court should look at legislative history. I want to go back to something the state said a couple of times about the language or the interpretation that we're putting forth was not actually adopted by the legislature. And I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding there. The drafting file reflects that there was this draft out there that suggested DOJ only could file petitions. That clearly was not adopted by the legislature. We're not saying that only DOJ can file petitions. The DA has authority after the conditions precedent have been met. And it's not a DOJ-only situation. It's a DOJ-first. The fact is that the language or the interpretation offered by the state is the one that was in the original bill and then was taken out by Amendment 2 adopted by the legislature. And that is the most salient point of legislative history, I think, in this case, that the interpretation offered by the state was changed by the legislature.
I think really it's a more focused question, though, rather than whether it's DOJ or DA and in which order. But the question really is who has the authority to make the charging decision in this case, if you will.
And that was
The DA and the DOJ, or is it the Department of Corrections?
Right. And that was another point I wanted to address.
And what support is there in the legislative history for reading these statutes in total and reasonably to reach the conclusion that the Department of Corrections is in the driver's seat here?
That was something I wanted to get to. Justice Prosser asked the question as well about why one concern he had about our position was giving total control to the agency with jurisdiction. In terms of the legislative history, I agree there's no absolute clear statement saying make the agency with jurisdiction the charging authority in this case. Give them all the decisions. Where it comes from is the inference from how the legislature structured the process for beginning the petition. It changed the bill from the DA having plenary authority with DOJ as a sort of pinch hitter to giving DOJ the first chance to file, but then only at the request of the agency with jurisdiction. And I think the only inference to be drawn from that is that there's got to be a decision made first by the agency with jurisdiction as to whether the criteria are met. Now, in terms of whether the policy for giving that sort of control to the agency with jurisdiction, I tried to go through some of the reasons in my first part of my argument. And I guess I would stress that it is a policy decision. There are policy arguments to be made for giving the district attorneys this kind of authority because, as the state points out, they're on sort of the front line dealing with people every day. But the attorney general, of course, is also an elected an official and also is charged with responsibility for protecting the people. And the bottom line is that the legislature, I think, has to sort of grapple and weigh and balance these two competing policy interests, and they chose this one. It may be that there are better arguments to be made for giving the DAs plenary authority. Those arguments should be made to the legislature.
This switch that occurred in the course of the drafting of this legislation from stating initially that the DA files and or then the DOJ at the request of the DA or the agency with jurisdiction, and then that got switched around, that was at the request of a legislative fiscal bureau, is that right? Am I reading your notes right?
It's actually, this was done in the Joint Committee on Finance. And
I'm looking at your Appendix 150 and 151, which you've referred us to earlier. It's a 1993
right.
drafting request.
And it says Fiscal Bureau.
Or LFB, which I assume is.
They staff the Joint Committee and on finance. So I think typically as a matter of drafting, it's prepared for them. Okay. And they're sort of like the. They're like an aid to the, like, who would deal with an aid to the legislator.
So it's not fair to assume that what precipitated this request were fiscal concerns? Or is it fair to assume that?
Well, I think that could have been part of it, but this wasn't a fiscal bureau initiative. This came from the Joint Committee on Finance, and I get that from the drafter's note, which is on page 149, which is that this is the draft 4713 as amended by the Joint Committee on Finance. And so it was the committee's direct action that made these decisions. And the bill was in finance because it did appropriate money.
And before you sit down, Mr. Olson, would you address yourself to Justice Prosser's question concerning your involvement and your prior role as
sure.
counsel in the
sure.
Legislative Reference Bureau
sure.
on this case? I assume that that's something you discussed with your present employer before accepting this position.
Right, right. And I have argued strictly from what is public record in the drafting file and inferences that I think anyone can take from this. I'm certainly not presenting myself as this is my intent, because my intent is irrelevant. It's the legislature's intent and what they enacted. And the job of this court obviously is to interpret the language and not say, well, Olson said that, it must be right.
And is there anything in the Attorney's Code of Ethics that would say that you might be conflicted out because of your involvement?
We looked at this early on, and as long as this is public information, I'm not revealing confidences of a former employer. And that's how we resolved that.
Chief, if I may, page 149.
Of the appendix?
Yeah. This is LRB A4713/1, as amended by the Joint Committee on Finance. Are there going to be records of the Joint Committee on Finance that are different from the records on microfiche maintained by the LRB?
The only records the LRB would be the microfiche drafting records. Whether the chief clerk's office or the fiscal bureau kept separate records of the finance proceedings, I'm not sure. They do keep some committee offices keep memos and some policy statements and things, but it's very inconsistent. And I did not check with the Fiscal Bureau or any other people who staff the Committee on Finance to see if there were other records, but there may be.
It just seemed to me if the members of the Finance Committee have a draft 4713 in front of them and amended, why isn't the public entitled to see that?
Well, as you know, having been in the legislature, sometimes drafts are requested and not introduced to be made public. And the Fiscal Bureau analysts, like the LRB attorneys, are subject to rules of confidentiality about those requests and those drafts. And because this was being done through a Fiscal Bureau analyst, it could be that he or she had the draft, and that was the starting point. It could be that the draft was in somehow being circulated among the whole committee. If it was, then it arguably is public, but it was not in the drafting file for Act 479. And if it was in the drafting file, it should clearly have been included in the appendix, because it would go into more detail about what proposals were in front of the committee. And if I could just ask, I know I've gone way over my time, but just Justice Prosser asked the state whether the evaluator, Dr. Wood, had seen Mr. Byers. There was a report attached to the petition filed in this case, which is record item number 2, and according to that evaluation, Dr. Wood based his opinion purely on a file review and not a personal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Olson, and thank you, Mr. Green. I believe this is the first time both of you have appeared before this court. Is that correct, Mr. Olson? You're second. Well, you're an old hand, but congratulations to both of you for an argument well done. Now, students, I believe, will be leaving and will be returning at about noon, and we are going to have another group of students. Perhaps. Are there students here? There are no students. Okay. We are then going to call, students may leave, and we are going to call the case that was originally scheduled as the third case. Why is the court leaving? They need